Morning, everybody. Shmuel Fatzer coming at you live at Golf Manor Synagogue, School of Jewish Studies. Very special Hanukkah class. We're doing it a little bit early today because this afternoon is going to be a big balagan. We all know that. Erev Shabbos, Erev Hanukkah. You got to light the Hanukkah candles. Then you got to light the Shabbos candles. And once you do that, game over. Because then you can't light any Hanukkah, and you can't do any malacha. And you should have a wonderful, wonderful Shabbos Kodesh. Where you could put aside all your driving the car and all your money matters and your computers and your internet and the cell phone and enjoy Shabbos Kodesh in peace. But in order for us to be able to come into Shabbos like that, we're moving this class a little bit early. We're going to give it right now. Welcome aboard, everybody, to our first Maccabees class. It's actually not our first Maccabees. It's the sixth installment of our class dedicated to the study and the reading of First Maccabees. So let's get right to it. Because tonight's going to be lighting the sixth candle, and it's going to be the sixth day tomorrow. Remember, today is day five. However, let's read about chapter six in the book First Maccabees. Let's get right to it. If you're going to be heading outside, please remember to zip up all the way, put your hood up, put your gloves on, and your boots. Without any of that stuff, you cannot go out because it's frostbite season out there. It's as cold as any day in Siberia ever could be. America's getting hit with quite the frost today. So bundle up and enjoy it. You know, before we get started, you know, the Scandinavians say there's no such thing as bad weather, only improper clothing. So let's keep that in mind. The weather is beautiful out there. That's what Hashem is giving us today. Super cold, you know, wind and it's snowy on the ground. Bundle up properly, cover up your hands and your feet and your head, and then go out and have a great time. Chapter 6 in 1 Maccabees. Here we go. Are you with me? You're not going to believe what you're going to hear. This is going to be a wild one. And when we're done with this class, I'm going to read to you a little piece from the book called Destiny by Kenneth Spiro, quoting Thomas Cahill, an Irish-American writer and scholar who wrote The Hinges of History. And in that book, I think he's also talking about, goodness, I think it's called something else, The Gifts of the Hebrews, I think. And you're going to see what he says about the Jewish people. As our man Steve Charlie says, you don't want to miss it. Here we go. Chapter 6. About that time, King Antiochus, traveling through the high countries, heard say that Elymais in the country of Persia was a city greatly renowned for riches, silver, and gold, and that there was in it a very rich temple, wherein were coverings of gold and breastplates and shields, which Alexander, son of Philip the First, the Macedonian king, who reigned first among the Grecians, had left there. It's like a whole treasure trove in some city called Elymais in Persia. No, Greek stuff. Wherefore he, Antiochus, came and sought to take the city and to spoil it. Of course, I would use the term to despoil it. To take the goods and stuff over there, all the gold and silver. But he was not able, because they of the city, having had warning thereof, rose up against him in battle. So he fled and departed thence with great heaviness and returned to Babylon. So he's getting kicked around by the Bnei Israel in Judah. The Jews in Judea are beating him down, his forces. And he just lost big time over here in Persia. And he could not retrieve the Grecian, you know, stuff from Alexander, the breastplates and shields and stuff that he had left over in that temple. So he came back with great heaviness. Verse 5. Moreover, there came one who brought him tidings into Persia that the armies which went against the lands of Judea were put to flight. He got a report. He got tidings. We hear that phrase a lot. Tidings of joy. Okay, it's a nice English word. Means news. Nias. Chadashot. What's the news? Ma Chadashot. What's the new? What's the information? What should I know? What's the developments? Oh, your people are getting beaten up in Judea. The Jews are fighting valiantly and beating down your forces in Judea. So this is like one defeat upon the other for this schnook, for Antiochus. You know, soon your heart's going to go after him. And we all hate his guts. Having read what he did to the Jewish people, you know, you hate him. Then you start reading this, and, oh, poor guy, he's losing badly, he lost in Persia. Don't have any rachmanis for this clown. But at all events, he's really on a downward spiral right now. He's hearing about the Jews beating up his forces in Judea, and that his forces were put to flight, and that Lysias, who went forth first with the great power, remember him, like the general Lysias, he was driven away of the Jews, and that they were made strong by the armor and power and store of spoils, which they had gotten of the armies whom they had destroyed. And the Jews got even stronger because they stole all the Greek stuff that they managed to despoil. When they beat down the Greek armies, they wound up keeping all the swords and spears and shields and the money that they were able to keep, because they won. They won the battle, so they got to keep all that stuff. They despoiled the Greeks. How about that? Remember, yeah, keep yourself nice and warm. Remember gloves. Good. Continuing. So this guy Lysias, who had gone forth with a great power and was driven away. Okay. 7. Also that they had pulled down the abomination. He got a report, Antiochus did, that the Jews were so successful that they pulled down the abomination which he had set up upon the altar in Jerusalem, and that they had compassed about the sanctuary with high walls, as before, and his city, Bethsura. The Jews were, you know, winning. They were doing very well. They were winning. Well, that's like the last thing Antiochus wants to hear. Now, when the king heard these words, he was astonished and sore moved, whereupon he laid him down upon his bed and fell sick for grief, because it had not befallen him as he looked for. Now, everything that he was looking forward to was crashing. Are we doing good in Judea? No, we're losing. How did we do just now in Persia? We lost. We're walking away. We're licking our wounds. What's going on in Judea again? Big losses, sir. Your Highness, big losses. What? Big losses. Yeah. See, he lays down in bed. He can't believe it. And there he continued many days in bed, for his grief was ever more and more. And he made account that he should die. He came to the point where he said, I am now on my way out of here. Wherefore he called for all his friends and said unto them, the sleep is gone from mine eyes, and my heart faileth for very care. Now listen to what he says. You're never going to hear this in any yeshiva anywhere. Maybe this is why the book is apocryphal and not part of the canon, because the words that are going to come out of Antiochus' mouth right now will shock your system. He says, I thought with myself, into what tribulation am I come, and how great a flood of misery is it wherein now I am, for I was bountiful and beloved in my power. But now I remember the evils that I did at Jerusalem, and that I took all the vessels of gold and silver that were therein, and sent to destroy the inhabitants of Judea without a cause. I did all that stuff for no good reason, says Antiochus. I tried to despoil Jerusalem, and I tried to take all the vessels of gold and silver that was there, and I attempted to destroy the inhabitants of Judea. I did it all, quote, without a cause. There was no reason whatsoever that I should have done any of that stuff. They never did anything bad to me. And there I suddenly woke up one day and said, ah, oh, we got to pound these Jews into the ground. Like, why are you doing that? And he's admitting on his deathbed, I did all that without a cause. I remember the evils, he says, the evils that I did in Yerushalayim. This Antiochus on his deathbed. We're going to find this in any other source but here. The last words of Antiochus before he died, how he had great regret for what he did to the Jewish people, how he bothered them and hurt them, killed them, and stole from them, and did the decrees against them without a cause. There was nothing done by the Jewish people to stop, to create this whole scenario. The Jews did nothing at all, such that Antiochus should hit them the way he did. But they did nothing. He's admitting it on his deathbed. I perceive, therefore, this is Antiochus continues, I perceive, therefore, that for this cause these troubles are come upon me. And behold, I perish through great grief in a strange land. He's not yet even in Antioch. He's not back in Syria. He's in Babylon, which is modern-day Iraq, which is east of Syria. He never seemingly got back to his homeland, and he's dying, as he says, in a strange land. And he's coming to terms. On his deathbed, he says, I think that the source of my tzuras is for what I did to the people in Judea. I perceive, therefore, that for this cause, for the things that I did to the Jews in Judea, these troubles are come upon me. That's what he's saying. He's coming to a realization that he made his own tzuras. Then called he for Philip, one of his friends, whom he made ruler over all his realm, and gave him the crown and his robe and his signet, to the end he should bring up his son Antiochus and nourish him up for the kingdom. I mean, he had given over his son Antiochus to Philip, to be raised by Philip. And now he's making Philip, looks like he's making Philip the king. Right? He called him for Philip, whom he made ruler over all his realm. He already made him the king. And he gave him the official crown and his robe, signet, and for what reason? He should bring up his son Antiochus. Is anything on the burner? Something burning? Something cooking? Please shut that down or open up a window. Please attend to the food. Got to be able to breathe in here. Thank you so much. A little fresh air would not hurt us. Thank you. So King Antiochus died there in the 149th year. Now when Lysias, remember Lysias is a general in the Greek army. Now when Lysias knew that the king was dead, he set up Antiochus, his son, whom he had brought up being young, to reign in his stead, and his name he called Eupator. So my impression is that Antiochus had a son, Antiochus. That's very wrong. Antiochus named a son after himself or his father, whatever, and others were, raising the kid up. Lysias was raising him up, or thought maybe Philip was doing that. At all events, we get the idea that Antiochus had a son, Antiochus. That's my understanding of all this. And that son was being raised by Philip and or Lysias helping out. And they were raising him so he should ultimately become the king. Okay, so again, now when Lysias knew that the king was dead, Antiochus, the bad guy that we know and hate, he, Lysias, set up Antiochus, his son. I don't think it's Lysias' son, Antiochus. I think it's the king's son, also known as Antiochus, whom he had brought up being young. Lysias was assisting in the raising of the child to reign in his stead, to reign instead of his own father, and his name he called Eupator.
We named the son.
Yeah. About this time, what's all the cold air coming in? About this time, they that were in the tower shut up the Israelites round about the sanctuary and sought always their hurt and the strengthening of the heathen. So again, about this time, there were apparently heathens in the tower. Okay? They shut up the Israelites round about the sanctuary. They encircled, apparently, they did what they could to encircle the the Jews around the base of Mikdash and sought always their hurt. They went out of their way to try to find a way to hurt the Jews and to strengthen the heathen, because they themselves were, of course, heathens. Wherefore Judas, purposing to destroy them, called all the people together to besiege them. So they're under attack by the heathens. So Judas says, let's go and fight them. Let's go destroy them. He's calling all the Jews together to besiege the heathens. So they came together, the Jews, that is, and besieged them, the heathens. The Jews fought back and started to besiege the heathens in the 150th year. And he, Judah, made mounts for shot against them and other engines, meaning and other mechanical devices. Howbeit, certain of them that were besieged got forth. Some of the guys who were under attack by the Jews ran away, unto whom some ungodly men of Israel joined themselves. Okay? They got forth, they snuck out. And who joined them? Unto whom some ungodly men of Israel joined themselves. And some Hellenizing Jews joined up with those heathens as they made an appearance in front of the king. Please close the window or the door. Or whatever it is over there, because the really super cold air is coming in. We only need one window. I don't know if we need more than one. Is there anything in the kitchen? Thank you so much. Sorry for this. It's just such a cold day. It's just ridiculously cold, and we just need some fresh air in here a little bit. Here we go. So these heathens, when they were joined up with these ungodly Jewish men, the Hellenizing Jewish men, they went unto the king, and they said, how long will it be ere thou execute judgment and avenge our brethren? How long is it going to be? How long does it have to take for you to slay our Jewish brethren who are sticking to the Torah? Okay? And of course, they say, and avenge our brethren. Obviously, they're talking about their own kind of fellow Hellenizers. How long will it be before you execute judgment and avenge our brethren, our loyal to you brethren, O King Antiochus? We have been loyal to you. How long is it going to take for you to pound away at the fellow Jews who are fighting us, and you should avenge our cause? We are sticking with you. We are Hellenizing Jews. We're on your side. How long does it take for you to do your job? Why aren't you going to avenge our brethren? We're dying for you. They continue, we have been willing to serve thy father and to do as he would have us and to obey his commandments, for which cause they of our nation besiege the tower and are alienated from us. They're fighting us because you put in motion laws against them. They keep the Torah law. We are with you, O King, and we're getting our heads handed to us, and the loyal Jews are winning, and they're besieging us. How long is this going to go on? Moreover, as many of us as they could light on, they slew and spoiled our inheritance. They're doing whatever they can. They're beating us every which way. As many of us as they could fall upon, they killed. And they spoiled our inheritance. Thank you so much. They are taking away our money and silver and gold that we ourselves stole. Or whatever. And there they're getting it. Neither have they stretched out their hand against us only, but also against all their borders. They're fighting against everybody who's on the borders with them, Idumeans and Edomites. They're beating everybody. A little help would be useful over here, King. And behold, this day are they besieging the tower at Jerusalem to take it. The sanctuary also and Bethsura have they fortified. Wherefore, if thou dost not prevent them quickly, they will do greater things than these. Neither shalt thou be able to rule them. If you let this keep on going, we got a problem here. Because they're going to just keep on winning. You're going to keep on losing. And before we know it, there won't be much left to talk about. And you won't be able to rule them ever. Now, when the king heard this, Peter was angry, and he gathered together all his friends and the captains of his army and those that had charge of the horses. The ones in charge of the horses. There came also unto him from other kingdoms and from isles of the sea, bands of hired soldiers, so that the number of his army was 120,000, 100,000 footmen. He had an army of 100,000 soldiers and 20,000 horsemen. He had 20,000 guys on horseback. That's pretty good. 100,000 on foot, 20,000 on horses, and 32 elephants exercised in battle. 32 elephants who knew their way around a battle zone. They had been in battle before, these elephants. They were being used by the Syrian Greeks, these elephants.
How did they get their hand on elephants?
They got all the way east to Persia. And maybe they had picked up some elephants over there. Elephants are certainly being used in India. That's where you mostly find them, that's my understanding. And we're going to see an absolute reference to the word Indian, an Indian riding on an elephant. So we're going to see that.
How did they know about India?
They knew because they were smart guys who were in the field. They were fighting wars, and they got their hands on people and maps, and they knew what was what, where was what, and all that. Okay. So he's got 100,000 soldiers, 20,000 horsemen, 32 elephants. These went through Idumea and pitched against Bethsura, which they assaulted many days, making engines of war. But they of Bethsura came out and burned them with fire and fought valiantly. So presumably the Jewish people in Bethsura were not taking anything lying down. They went out and they fought as valiantly as they could. Upon this, Judah removed from the tower and pitched in Bat-Zacharias, Beit-Zachariah, over against the king's camp. Then the king, rising very early, marched fiercely with his host toward Beit-Zachariah, where his armies made them ready to battle and sounded the trumpets. He's going to try to take on Beit-Zachariah. And that's where Judah is, to meet Yehuda HaMaccabee over there. And to the end they might provoke the elephants to fight, they showed them the blood of grapes and mulberries. In order to get the elephants ready for battle, they fed them grapes and mulberries. Moreover, they divided the beasts among the armies, and for every elephant they appointed 1,000 men, armed with coats of mail and with helmets of brass on their heads. And beside this, for every beast were ordained 500 horsemen of the best. Every elephant got 500 horsemen and 1,000 soldiers. These were ready at every occasion. Wheresoever the beast was, and whithersoever the beast went, they went also. Neither departed they from him. They stayed with that beast the whole time. That was their enormous tank. That was an ancient tank. These enormous animals. You know, they just keep on coming at you. And they're enormous and they're heavy. And it was the ancient equivalent of a tank. And upon the beasts were their strong towers of wood, which covered every one of them, and were girt fast unto them with devices. So every single elephant had what we call these strong towers of wood. Okay? There were also upon every one 32 strong men. Every elephant had 32 strong men on them that fought upon them, beside the Indian that ruled him. I love that. Beside the Indian, and there's the phrase, right? They had an Indian man who was running every elephant. An Indian elephant rider, and then 32 Syrian Greek soldiers. How is it out there? Cold.
Yeah.
That's the impression I'm getting. Windy and cold, it is. Okay. Beside the Indian that was ruling over the elephant and driving the elephant forward. Remember to hang up your stuff. Okay. As for the remnants of the horsemen, they set them on this side and that side at the two parts of the host, giving them signs what to do and being harnessed all over amidst the ranks. My impression is from that, they put horsemen on both sides of the elephant. They set those horsemen on this side and that side at the two parts of the host. Two parts of the host animal. The animal is hosting that little cohort. On that animal are 32 guys on top, and you have soldiers on the bottom. You have horsemen riding along. It's just a whole, it's an entire like battalion, right? Okay. Now when the sun shone upon the shields of gold and brass, the mountains glistened therewith and shined like lamps of fire. So part of the king's army being spread upon the high mountains and part on the valleys below, they marched on safely and in order. Wherefore all that heard the noise of their multitude and the marching of the company and the rattling of the harness were moved, for the army was very great and mighty. The Greeks were high and mighty and looking for blood. They're out to try to destroy Judah and the boys. Will they succeed? Then Judah and his host drew near and entered into battle, and there were slain of the king's army 600 men. What do you call that? I call that a good start. Verse 43. Eleazar, also surnamed Sabaran, perceiving that one of the beasts, meaning one of the elephants, armed with royal harness, was higher than all the rest, and supposing that the king was upon him, Eleazar thought, okay, I see one elephant. He's bigger than the rest of them, and he's got a royal harness. So maybe the king is on top of that animal. I'm going to go get that animal and destroy that animal. I'm going to destroy that elephant. He put himself in jeopardy to the end he might deliver his people and get him a perpetual name. Wherefore he ran upon him courageously through the midst of the battle, slaying on the right hand and on the left hand, so they were divided from him on both sides. Which done, or in other words, when finally completed, he crept under the elephant, Eleazar did, and thrust him under and slew him. He killed the elephant. What do you think happens when an elephant drops dead and you're underneath it? We got a problem here. Whereupon the elephant fell down upon him and there he died. Yeah, you got to be careful when you're killing an elephant that you don't do it from underneath the elephant. Because when the elephant starts to collapse, it'll be like the Philistine temple with Samson bringing it down. Everybody in it died. Howbeit, however, the rest of the Jews, seeing the strength of the king and the violence of his forces, turned away from them. Looks like the Jews are now on the run. Then the king's army went up to Jerusalem to meet them, and the king pitched his tents against Judea and against Mount Zion.
So, but can you hear the king Zion, the big elephant?
Oh, I guess all we know is that all we know is that the Jewish guy died. We don't hear that move killed the Greek king. Apparently, that was not the case. He was not riding on top of that elephant. Okay, at least I don't think so. All right, here we go. Now, again, the king's army went up to Jerusalem to meet them, and the king pitched his tents against Judea and against Mount Zion. But with them that were in Bethsura, he made peace. He proposed peace to the inhabitants of Bethsura, for they came out of the city because they had no victuals there to endure the siege. They ran out of food. It being a year of rest to this land, because it was a Shemitah year. How about that? It was a Shemitah year all the way back there during this Hanukkah story. And people didn't have a whole lot of food in their plate. And so they were willing to talk peace. They came out of the city, meaning to meet him and greet him, because they had no victuals there to endure the siege. They had no food. So the king took Betsura and set a garrison there to keep it.
What does that mean?
He won over control of the city of Betsura, and he set up forces to maintain his newly won ownership of the city. He took Betsura and he set a garrison there to keep it. He set up a battalion, a force of military guys to make sure that they would not lose Betsura in a war with Judah. Okay. Continuing. As for the sanctuary, meaning as for the base of Mikdash, he besieged it many days. Bless. And he set their artillery with engines and instruments to cast fire and stones and pieces to cast darts and slings. Whereupon they also made engines against their engines and held them battle a long season. It was a long, long battle between the Jews and the Syrian Greeks. Yet at the last, their vessels being without victuals, at the author saying, at the end of the day, their plates were lacking food. And in parentheses, for that it was the seventh year, and they in Judea that were delivered from the Gentiles had eaten up the residue of the store. They had stored away food because it was going to be Shemitah year. Well, now it's all eaten up. Now what are we going to do? There were but a few left in the sanctuary. Jewish people had been in the base of Mikdash. Now only a few were there. Because the famine did so prevail against them that they were fain to disperse themselves, every man to his own place. They were fain, they were happy, they were pleased, they were content, they were perfectly willing to go along with the program. They were fain, it's an archaic term. You don't hear anybody say it anymore, for the most part. But in the King James, yes. They were fain to disperse themselves, every man to his own place. They were happy to have that income. They were fain to disperse, they were fain to disperse themselves. They were perfectly happy to run away, every man to his own place. At that time, Lysias heard say that Philip, whom Antiochus the king, whilst he lived, had appointed to bring up his son Antiochus, that he might be king, that this man Philip was returned out of Persia and Media, and the king's host also that went with him, and that he sought to take unto him the ruling of the affairs. So Lysias is seeing that Philip is coming back, and he looks like he's got his eyes on the kingship. Wherefore he went in all haste and said to the king and the captains of the host and the company, we decay daily, and our victuals are but small, and the place we lay siege unto is strong, and the affairs of the kingdom lie upon us. Now, therefore, let us be friends with these men, and make peace with them, and with all their nation. How about that for a Syrian Greek? Now, therefore, let us be friends with these men, and make peace with these men, and with all their nation, and covenant with them that they shall live after their laws, as they did before. For they are therefore displeased, and have done all these things, because we abolished their laws. Let's just give them back. Let's let them continue to keep their law. We'll have some peace. Let me just reread that. Now therefore let us be friends with these men, says the Syrian Greek, and make peace with them, with the Jews, and with all their nation, and covenant with them that they shall live after their laws, as they did before. For they are therefore displeased, and have done all these things, because we abolished their laws. So the king and the princes were content. Wherefore he sent unto them to make peace, and they accepted thereof. Also the king and the princes made an oath unto them, whereupon they went out of the stronghold. Then the king entered into Mount Zion, but when he saw the strength of the place, he brake his oath that he had made and gave commandments to pull down the wall round about. Last sentence. Afterward departed he in all haste and returned unto Antiochia, where he found Philip to be master of the city. So he fought against him and took the city by force. Okay, that's the end of chapter 6. Let me just conclude with a most beautiful reading of the gifts of the Jewish people. In antiquity, even, they realized it. Okay? This is Philo Stratus, a 2nd century Roman writer. He said about the Jewish people, "For the Jews have long been in revolt, not only against the Romans, but against humanity. They are a race that has made its own life apart and irreconcilable, that cannot share with the rest of mankind in the pleasures of the table, nor join in their libations or prayers or sacrifices. They are separated from ourselves by a greater gulf than divides us from Sura or Bactra of the most distant Indies." Okay, and finally, what do the Jewish people do for the world? Thomas Cahill, the famous Irish-American scholar and writer, author of the book The Hinges of History, has pointed out the following. Quote, "The Jews gave us a whole new vocabulary, a whole new temple of the spirit, an inner landscape of idea and feelings that had never been known before. Because of their unique belief, monotheism, the Jews were able to give us the great whole, a unified universe that makes sense, and that, because of its evident superiority as a worldview, completely overwhelms the warring and contradictory phenomena of polytheism. They gave us the conscience of the West, the belief that this God who is one is not the God of outward show, but the still small voice of conscience, the God of compassion, the God who will be there, the God who cares about each of his creatures, especially the human beings created in his image, and that he insists we do the same. The Jews gave us the outside and the inside, our outlook and our inner life. We can hardly get up in the morning or cross the street without being Jewish. We dream Jewish dreams and hope Jewish hopes. Most of our best words, in fact, new, adventure, surprise, unique, individual, person, vocation, time, history, future, freedom, progress, spirit, faith, hope, justice, are the gifts of the Jews." Incredible. What we have given to the world, what do we get back in return? Sometimes a whole lot of hate. Sometimes three beautiful paragraphs like that, where we have friends who understand the unique contribution given to us by the Almighty, and we in turn turned it around and shared it with the world. Cahill writes that we also gave the world its moral furniture, the furniture of the mind, without which we wouldn't even have a vocabulary to describe morality and decency. A world of polytheism, Thor and Zeus and Hermes and Hector and all the rest of those nothings won't get you very far. And so God had to wipe it out. Ultimately, he did. So even though we lost against the Romans, he writes over here, the Jews also fought against the Romans, but this time there was no Hanukkah miracle. And they were badly beaten and exiled from the land of Israel. Yet though they lost that battle, they ultimately won the war. Today, most of the world subscribes to monotheism, while idol worship is the stuff of ancient history. So true. So true. The paganism that ran rampant throughout ancient Greece and then ancient Rome was ultimately displaced by Greek Orthodox Christianity and Roman Catholicism. And they completely wiped out, I shouldn't say completely, they adopted into their Catholicism, there were some adoptions of certain pagan customs and so on. But at least they got them to stop worshiping the Zeus and the and Jupiter and Venus and Mars and Pluto and all the other planets. And that was a tremendous foot forward for all humanity. And the Jewish people, well, it was thanks to us and our monotheism that spawned those other two religions, the daughter religions of Christianity and Islam, which made monotheism sweep around the whole wide world. With that, hopefully it's uplifting enough. I want to wish everybody a very, very enjoyable day. Please stay careful, stay safe, stay warm, stay indoors if you can. If you must go outside, remember to bundle up. It's frostbite weather out there. Please don't spend too much time outdoors. Pour yourself a hot cup of coffee or hot cocoa and enjoy. Look out the window and see a beautiful white landscape. Some people who are hoping for a white holiday on Sunday and their holiday, can they gonna get it finally? But nobody expected, Siberian Arctic weather quite like this. This is just completely out of the blue. I knew about it days ago, but I wasn't kind of really believing it. Then when it hits you, it's 1 degree out there. Somebody says it's minus 10, minus 20, whatever it is. It is truly, truly cold. Please be careful. Wishing everybody a great day, a very happy Hanukkah to one and all. On this, the fifth day of Hanukkah, tonight we light the sixth candle. Wish everybody a very joyous Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh and Hanukkah. This is a trifecta, yet you don't want to miss in shul over Shabbos. Shabbos, Hanukkah, and Rosh Chodesh. Three Sifrei Torah coming out. It is a supercharged day. If you can make it to shul safely, please do so. Everybody have a great Erev Shabbos, a great day of Hanukkah. Enjoy Shabbos, Hanukkah, Rosh Chodesh, and with God's help. How about we have another class tomorrow night? How about if we call for the class a little bit on the later side so people can catch their breath and we can do certain, have a meal and hang out with your family and friends and your neighbors? How about if we call our class for 9 o'clock tomorrow night? We'll continue with First Maccabees tomorrow night after Shabbos Kodesh is concluded and you light the candles and you hang out and you have a love Malka. Let's have a class at 9 o'clock tomorrow night for the next chapter of Maccabees. That'll be chapter 7. How about that? Wishing everybody a great one. Good Shabbos, a good Chodesh, and fair Lech Hanukkah. School Philosophy signing off for Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. Thank you, Jake. Thank you, Mitch, up in Chicagoland, for all that you do for SheerEnjoyment.com and for all of us here in Cincinnati and throughout the country. Everybody who enjoys your Shiurim, we have you to thank. Have a great holiday, a great Shabbos and Chodesh and Hanukkah. See everybody tomorrow night, 9 o'clock. Take care and be well. Bye for now.